The show that doesn't grab them by the but does occasionally kick them in the balls. It's the Shaggy Jenkins Show on the Pacifica Radio Network.
It's the Shaggy Jenkins Show on the Pacifica Radio Network. Welcome to it. Boy, do we have a lot to cover today, including a very emotional week at the house as Jon Stewart comes to town. And this isn't his first time. We'll also talk about Donald Trump and his misunderstanding of everything to do with Constitution and government this week, how that could also get the Attorney General in trouble, Warren and Sanders, and oh God, we've got so much to cover. Before we get to all of that, brief introductions are in line. Hi, my name is Shaggy Jenkins. I'm the host of the show and owner of the website ShaggyJenkins.com. And I'll apologize in advance. It needs updating. You can also find me at Shaggy Live. My correspondent today comes to us from the Windy City, which looking rather dapper tonight. Ladies and gentlemen, last week he was out because he was literally information headquarters. This week he's back with us. Please welcome Chris Bass.
You have overcome, for I am here. I'm back, and always good to be with you, Shaggy. I'm sorry I missed last week, but I've returned. So how you doing, man?
So far, so good. But I'm going to admit, like, when it comes to the weekend news, our first story, and we talked about this on our pre-show that people can watch if they follow us on social media, where we do our live stream before every show. But there's a very emotional story this week that I swear it's like the season finale of 6 Feet Under. You cannot watch it or rewatch it without getting a little choked up. And that's, of course, talking about Jon Stewart. Let's start with Jon Stewart this week. How did he break America's heart, Chris?
Well, he gave Congress definitely what they needed on Tuesday, blasting the House Judiciary Subcommittee about the indifference towards the plight of 9/11, a first responder that testified on behalf of them for the September 11th Victims Compensation Fund. And when you watch it, I've seen in the segments, I know you talk about, you saw the whole thing. Even in segments, it's still powerful. And I put all together, you know, how it all went down. When you're looking at a very incredible situation where these people need their funds, you talk about a tragic situation in our American history of 9/11. I have to tell you or anybody else what happened, obviously. But the first responders saved lots of lives. Case in point, I remember when, like most of us, were watching on TV during that time and watching New York going through all this. And I was still working at WLS Radio here in Chicago, the ABC affiliate radio station. And I'm covering all this in my home, so I go back to the job, and then we went wall to wall. But prior to that, I was watching other networks, and one anchor was saying to on CBS that a firefighter had protected her while the second building went down, and all the crumbling and all the dust and everything else. He literally shielded her so that she wouldn't be as affected from it. So when I saw stories like that, of course, reading stories over the years, it doesn't matter what side of the table you are when it comes to politics. This is a human thing, not Democratic or Republican. It's a human thing. But the fact that Jon Stewart called him on the table and called him out, I thought was a master stroke. He obviously is emotional about it, rightfully so. He believes in the fund, which is why he spoke up for them on not just this time, other occasions as well. But I think it galvanized the point that there are times when the government needs to do what's right for people, not what's right for a certain interest of their party.
You know, the thing about Jon Stewart this week is that he has displayed, once again, a tenacity for the first responders of 9/11. And this goes way, way back, like you were saying. Let's not forget that his first statement, his first live show after 9/11 occurred, one of the first things he did was thank first responders and talk about their bravery and their commitment to honor and duty despite overwhelming odds and, of course, hidden at that time in unknown dangers yet to come. Now, as time has progressed, he used his platform on The Daily Show time and time again on the yearly anniversary of 9/11 to bring up to light the first responder. And over the years, depressingly, He had a round table that started off with a bunch of people, six of them, in fact, and whittled down toward the end of his run as the host of The Daily Show to just one guy. Now, Chris, when he went to D.C., another one of the people that time and time and time again helped him lobby for the 9/11 fund, an officer by the name of Ray, and he mentioned him through his speech, he wasn't there this time. And that seemed to, at most times when you've seen John Stewart in the past go to the Hill and Ray has been there, John has been kind of a little bit calmer. But this time, in his own word, I'm sorry if I'm angry and undiplomatic, but I'm angry. Do you think that the fact that the clock is ticking down on a lot of people that John Stewart has from day one shown a massive amount of support for, do you think that with time ticking down, this explains his escalation from, hey, I'm the guy that's just, you know, randomly asking a question, why don't you take care of them, to I'm now persistently asking the question, to now I'm angry and undiplomatic. Do you think the clock has anything to do with this, Chris?
Well, absolutely. I mean, yeah, the thing about 9/11 that happened all those years ago to where we are 2019, yes, that's a long time. Anything could happen during that time. I think it was moved expeditiously and a little more firepower behind it that was able to get it done in a quicker fashion. We would not have John Stewart as a story. Had they taken care of business earlier, and once again, I understand how government works to some degree, but there have been times where you have executive orders to take care of something because of a certain timeline. It has to be rushed. I know you go through a series of processes, but in this situation, it should have been you have to put aside everything else for what had happened at 9/11. This and it could be a strong executive order and bypass all the red tape and get it done. But no, like government at times, like to extend, be stalemate about it, and you don't really get things done. And you cannot play with people's lives. And that's what happens in government. I think government sometimes forgets that when it comes to us, we're the ones that vote these people into office. And then there's sometimes, you know, some certain politicians get into power and don't even think about that. Well, they want to, you know, talk about you when it comes back to being reelected. And when you have all that plus other things that was going on with trying to get this passed, obviously become frustrated, obviously become sick and tired, obviously become mad. And that's what he displayed. I think he was brilliant at showing the frustration and not holding back, because government needs to hear that. When he said that you should be ashamed of yourself, some of those people even show up. That's an insult to these people who save lives, for God's sake. But no, when you look at it from the perspective of, look, it's just another issue. No, it's not. It's not special. You should have approached it, some of these politicians, like it was your family member that got killed in 9/11. It was your family member that went out and tried to do something for a first response position. We don't want to, at times, personalize it for fear of, I don't know, showing emotion like John Stewart did, for fear of trying to acclimate yourself to have a compassion like he displayed. But the main thing that I got out of it was the fact that he put the Judiciary Committee on blast, the subcommittee on blast, and they needed that.
They really did, because when you talk about being on blast, this is, once again, a guy that when the 9/11 fund first came up for a little bit of disruption, he jumped on the bandwagon and defended. And time and time and time again, Stewart has shown his commitment to this. And this is the craziest thing that I'm going to bring up. Right in the middle of John Stewart's almost, I want to say more tyranny part of his address to the House, he made mention of it's inadequate that these first responders, nay, all Americans, worry about health care bankrupting them. Now, isn't that crazy that John Stewart, right in the middle of the 9/11 fund, which he once again reiterated, clock is ticking on these guys. There's cancer, there's respiratory diseases, there's PTSD that some of them are dealing with. A lot of them can't be there because their bodies are riddled with cancer. But we need to commit to paying these guys health care. And oh, by the way, kind of sucks that nobody else has health care too. Is there some sort of, because there was a lot of people that took that as, hey, John Stewart, please be the president that we need moment. But is there some sort of aspiration for politics in John Stewart, you believe?
No, I don't think so. I think that he was just being a concerned representative for the 911 victims fund and first responders. What he displayed is natural emotion, obviously, that we don't see in our current administration. I see it go out all the time, be weepy, but with the current administration being what they are, they're very cold. They come off very rigid, my way or the highway type of thing. And that's not how everybody responds. And that becomes the status quo when it comes to the current government. Here comes a person who's the exact opposite that attracts those people. Say, you know what? That's what we need. We need somebody who hits hard, doesn't beat around John Bush, and you need someone who's going to give it to you straight, no chaser. And with the current administration being what it is, we're not hearing or seeing that. And we've seen in John Stewart, who obviously wants to do the right thing to help these first responders to get the health care that they need, but instead you're fighting an uphill battle. Because again, this is a situation that should not have ran into any type of brick walls whatsoever. None whatsoever. But when you're frustrated and you see what he said about being riddled with bodies and inhaling asbestos and things like that, where it destroys the body and you need health care. Why is this taking so long? And because of his reaction, people galvanize towards that. They see emotion. And I think this time in our lives right now, nothing wrong with that. I think, again, very brave of him to do so.
You know, and one of the things is that we have to mention, in the aftermath of his emotional testimony this week, the House unanimously passed the fund. And this was something that is remarkable because, Chris, not a lot of people went there to see the testimony. So, I mean, did these guys get warned by their constituency, hey, you might want to get on YouTube and see what John Stewart said to your chair? Is there some sort of pressure because of John Stewart's passion that people were like, no, even if you weren't in that committee, this is a yes vote, period?
If people took time out to do that, like you just said, to call their constituents, call their administration, call their politician, and put pressure on them, we would get a lot of stuff done. We really would. Not just segmented positions like this. Don't be wrong. It's a great cause. And again, it should have been done a long time ago. But what if we use it as an example to do other things with, for infrastructure, for jobs, and whatever else you feel is important, to get people to support, to call their local politicians, to put the squeeze play on them? If we can get that done for that, imagine other things as well. So, yeah, because they want to keep their, what I call their phony baloney jobs, these politicians. They need it. So, look, if you're going to put the pressure on me, I got to keep my Rolls Royce or Bentley or with certain politicians, I hate to say this, my side piece happy. I got to go along to go along just so that the onus won't be on me. I want to, like, my job is great. I got people paying me. I got the government paying me. I got, you know, other constituents paying me, so like that. You know, I got to look. I don't want to ruin the apple cart. Do not mess the church's money. So I'm going to do what is right. Even though they may not even give two damns, they'll do it anyway just to keep appearances up.
You know, and that's the thing. This does seem to be the administration of appearances. And one of the things that really made a big appearance this week is the tough facade of the Trump administration. Even in issues like the emotional testimony of John Stewart, which, let's just go ahead and be honest, did not affect Donald Trump. It takes empathy to do that. But when it comes to some of the bigger stories this week, one of the things that is adamant is that Trump's administration and its stonewalling of the House isn't going to last much longer. We hit a kind of a big crux this week with William Barr, didn't we?
Yes, we did. I mean, here's the thing about William Barr before we get into it. When you watch him during the time, he just came off so arrogant, like we were wasting his time and he's working for us. That alone showed the fact of, it's not about you. Mr. Barr. It's about what's at stake. So there's a civil contempt resolution in this situation. The House Judiciary Committee issued a subpoena during this time, during the Mueller administration, not the Mueller administration, but the Mueller report, of the unredacted copy that they were trying to give and gave. People, when it comes to A.G. William Barr or others, people want some semblance of the truth. Get the whole truth? No, we won't. That's impossible. But some semblance of it, of what I call it. If you come into a situation and say, I'm going to give you a redacted version of this report, off the bat, your alarm should go off. Now, wait. What's the redacted version? Why are you going to and edit it? The version that's supposed to be intact, which was why Robert Mueller at that final press conference pretty much said, look, we've done our job for 2 years. I'm going back to the private, you know, sector. I saw some discrepancies in Donald Trump's, you know, situation. It's up to Congress. He pretty much said Congress has to take this from here. So going back to William Barr and this appearance of this is beneath me, I'm above you and things like that. Nobody wants that. Nobody wants to see that. So the fact that they are going to a civil contempt at this point, which they're pushing towards A.G. Barr, is the right move to do.
You know, one of the things that got me about the whole civil contempt thing is, okay, there's two levels of contempt for Congress. There is a actual contempt of court or contempt of subpoena of the House, which is felony level prosecution. And as such, there's a higher, what we call, degree of proof that needs to be presented in court for something like that to proceed. There is a higher criminality, including imprisonment and fines and stuff that can be imposed at that rate. Now, the other rate, which is the one that the House seems to be going for, is civil contempt. And this one is a little bit faster to get moving through the courts. But also, Chris, it attaches a monetary kind of punishment to it and does allow the House Dems to besmirch the GOP's reputation. Exactly how did William Barr see this actually playing out when this whole thing started?
I don't think he saw it played out at all. I think that he was brought in as a hired gun, quote unquote, to go in there and to push the agenda of the Trump administration. To go in there, obviously, what we talked about just now, to redact the Mueller report, to go in there as pretty much a keeper at the gate for Trump. And so I believe because of his arrogance, not only did he go back to the 1980s with him being involved in Iran-Contra during that scandal, of course, under the Reagan administration. So under his belt, he has this authoritative figure that, well, you know, I'm William Barr and you're not, type of thing. And that ego gets in the way of progress, where we are right now with the civil contempt, which, of course, you just said, leads to fines and possibly jail time. I don't think he saw that into it. I just think that he believes that he's Teflon, like the president. I'm going to go in here and just, you know, say, even like I said before, you're wasting my time, what do you want from me, type of thing. And that's how he came off. And, you know, it's like, how dare you? I mean, to the Judiciary Committee, I mean, House, how dare you? You know, this is our job. We're doing this to find out what's in the Mueller report. And once again, you went in there, you know, did your cutting and pasting. We want to question you about that. And that's what happened. So when you look at the civil contempt of it, I just don't believe, because of his arrogance, that he thought it would get this far.
You know, one of the things that really gets in your crawl, as they would say where I'm from, really gets in the crawl of things is this week, William Barr does seem to not only be throwing up the wall, as it were, towards the investigation into the Mueller report and, of course, the release of the full unredacted and all concerning materials around that report. But there's also Mueller is on his way out right as William Barr is starting to bring people in and start a timeline questioning of what led to this investigation into Russia. Is the word defiant or treasonous the one that actually applies here?
You can phase one to the other, Shaggy. You look at the timeline of all this, it started off, I think, with what you said, going into treason. Because now you get into a whole different territory when I believe you're protecting the president. Once again, being a keeper of the gate, keeping the people at bay. And you're keeping the narrative going again. There's no collusion, nothing going on here. You'll keep it moving on, people. People, I think some are tired of this rhetoric. And it has to be challenged. And it has to ask questions. What they want you or I or anybody else to go away is that just please go away. Like, you know, cops, nothing to see here. Keep it moving type of thing. And we won't go. And that's part of the problem. They're very upset that we have not fought for the okey-doke. We're asking questions. We're trying to find out, once again, some semblance of truth here because the American people deserve it.
You know, I mean, as long as they're going to give us some sort of vaudevillian stereotypical situation, where is the American / Scottish / Bobby, we don't know if he's upstate New York cop guy, going, move along, sonnies, there's nothing to see here. Nothing on the report, no collusion, no guilt. I mean, you know, as long as we're taking the okey-doke, as you say, why don't they just give us the full, you know, the full footlong there? I failed to see, though, when we look at this story, because William Barr is being very, very just, like you said, arrogant. But I fail to see how this story can be isolated this week like the GOP wants it, when we kind of noticed this trend. And this is kind of one of the last things I want to get into before we run into our break in a couple of minutes. But this story is kind of interesting. Ever since William Barr started his defiance of the House, and of course, you know, Donald Trump tried to issue a blanket executive order over a bunch of stuff, then issued another one over Don McGahn, then just recently released another executive order covering up the, the census questions and Hope Hicks testimony. With all of this stuff coming to light and Donald Trump escalating these type of public defiance things in action, is there any wonder why his ratings have kind of taken a slump as of late, Chris?
Well, yeah, because people are tired of him using his bully pulpit to position people to, once again, protect him. And again, when no matter, I hope we take our politics, once again, the both sides of the aisle, it's the fact that what he's doing is extremely wrong and you're abusing your power. And this would be said if he was Democrat or Republican, doesn't matter who's in office. When you abuse your power, you will be called to task about it.
You know, and this is the thing about abusing powers, because Trump seems to think that that's what his base wants. They want this kind of, dare I say, big phallic energy that Donald Trump wants to walk around with. And they think that that's, well, at least he and all of his advisors, that's what they think his base will get energized by. But if you're looking at Twitter engagement, not only is Trump kind of taking a hit in the Gallup poll, where he's almost like 16 points behind Joe Biden at this point, if election were to be held today, which, by the way, Democrats, Biden isn't your candidate yet. Okay. But if there was an election run today, yes, Trump is way behind and way down in the polls. However, this kind of slump has been brought on by his own actions, because now if you look at his Twitter engagement, it too took a very sharp dip as soon as he started using the platform to really go against his political opponent. Is Trump going to be his own defeat?
Well, personally, I hope so. But we'll see in time. You know, you could be your own worst enemy. Be careful. And again, going back to ego, going back to a position of, you know, this is who I am and you're not, that rubs people the wrong way, even people in your own party. Because we know who you are. It's like, for example, if he comes into a meeting, hey, everybody, I'm the president. Yeah, we know that. Yeah, I'm the president. Yeah, we know that. I'm the president. Yeah, that's the third time. We knew before we walked into the room. So when you keep on sticking your chest out like that and, you know, having that type of walk, people get tired of that. We know who you are. You have to tell, who are you trying to convince? People around you or trying to convince yourself?
You know, maybe Bette Midler had something to do with it after all.
Maybe.
I know it's kind of weird, but we do have to talk about the unprecedented of this president when it comes to attacking individuals using social media, because every time he does it, he breaks another we're not supposed to do that in an office kind of rule. But Chris, is he going to slow down?
I don't think so. I would dare say not. He will keep on going.
Yeah, because if he keeps on going at this rate, it's looking like with the latest polling that Trump could easily find himself on the downward spiral with his own mouth to blame. Now, here's the thing. Have you ever engaged with the president on Twitter before?
No, I have not.
You know, I know a lot of joke accounts of people that are very liberal. Let's just go ahead and say this. Joke accounts that have been following and going after the president for a while. This is the funny thing. Out of 9 of them that I actually know exist, 8 of them quit. And they simply just said, well, you know, it's not funny anymore. It's just kind of, meh. Trump says something crazy.
Right. I can see that. Because unfortunately, that become commonplace.
Yeah. And that's kind of crazy because he's made bad behavior from a president pretty common.
Yeah. That, unfortunately, you're right.
Oh, God. Well, you know, here's the thing. We've got to take a break real quick. When we get back, we'll talk a little bit more about, well, executive privilege, Warren, Sanders, who's ahead, plus a couple more things. Stay close. It's the Shaggy Jenkins Show.
From the guy a bit off center and slightly out of his mind. It's the Shaggy Jenkins Show on the Pacifica Radio Network.
It's the Shaggy Jenkins Show on the Pacifica Radio Network. Welcome back to it. Boy, do we have a lot to cover in our second half, but if you missed our first half, boy, you missed a good half. You can check us out on the iHeart app as well as Spotify, iTunes, what have you. Just look for the Shaggy Jenkins Show and make sure you subscribe. Joining me from the windy city of Chicago, where right now, let's just be honest, behind the scenes, we're having a contest of who can be more humid. Please welcome Stormfront from the North of Information. It is Chris Bate.
Thank you, Shaggy. It's always good to be back with you, man. So, yeah, stay cool, brother. I know it's not easy. You talk about humidity and heat and everything else, and look, I can relate. It is not fun. It is not easy to go through. It's very funky. And I'm sure at times you don't want to smell funk outside of your home, but some people just don't bathe. And it's just not good to smell that in the air when it's, you know, humidified combined with that. It's very functified, sir.
Ooh, yeah. And you know what else has the stink of death on it? Donald Trump's use of executive privilege.
There you go.
Yeah, let's talk about that, because this week he has once again tried to assert executive privilege over two important kind of things. One is, of course, the question of citizenship on the 2020 census. And two is the testimony of one Hope Hicks. Now, for a guy that has publicly said that Hope Hicks is like his other daughter, which I guess that means he wants to bone her, the president does seem rather protective of Hope Hicks, doesn't he?
I dare say overprotective. Very.
You know, and this is the thing about that protection. Can, and this is something that I thought was really, really fascinating, because this week we also had testimony from two law professors on the House that basically said, hey, I'm going to tell you how obstruction of justice works and what basically is obstruction of justice in a legally scholarly kind of way. And oh, by the way, our president done it a couple of times, and here's the examples of those. That was kind of a thing that went under everybody's radar. But when it came to Hope Hicks' story, Donald Trump kind of hoped that this whole going after people within his administration would go away, and the second he didn't, out comes the executive privilege. We're not supposed to call it the other thing, are we?
it's too late. You just go on and say it. Just go on and say it.
You know, this is white privilege on a massive scale, because the president basically, time and time again, has said, I should have the right to do whatever I want to because I'm the head of the federal government and those people voted for President Trump, which I think it's kind of creepy that he keeps talking about himself in third person. But then the executive orders come out, and each time they're used to almost a backlash effect where people see him using these things, and instead of it coming off as a strong authoritarian person, which, let's face it, those are the type of people he admires, it kind of comes off as a little bit of stonewall-y obstructionist, and people are getting a little tired of it, aren't they?
They are. I mean, again, when you're voted to the highest office of the land, they want you to do the right thing. Do the right thing from some realistic possibility. You're not going to nail it all the time or get it 100 all the time. At least try to get it to, I would probably say, the 75, 80 percentile to make it happen. If you're very fortunate to have a good administration and cabinet around you to help these things being pulled off. But again, I think people are sick, and they're beyond sick and tired of trying to see the president or administration to do what's right, but they're not. They're very self-serving, very, once again, my way or the highway type mentality. And this doesn't bode well, not only for here in America, but across, you know, the world as well. You know, they do look at us as leadership. I think maybe they used to, they were more a laughingstock, this point of phrase right now, of other countries, of other positions of power. And being a world leader comes, you know, responsibilities that are through the roof. And once upon a time, I think we could handle that, but now we're a joke because of who's in office. And again, when you're looking at trying to say, for example, you know, help others or come off as though we're Teflon and we're wasting our time kind of thing again, you know, that's across the board, whether it's the president, whether, you know, it's Sarah Huckabee Sanders, whether it's A.G. William Barr, they had the same snarky mentality. It's there across the board. Birds of a feather. It's the same thing. So who wants that? Unless that's part of your DNA, unless that's how you operate on a daily basis, that you like stuff like that, then you go ahead. I highly disagree with that. I don't think it's the way to go. But again, we had this executive privilege that, again, he's using, the bully pulpit mentality. He's protecting his own because he knows that he can do that. If he couldn't do it, he'd find some way to do it anyway.
You know, and the thing about Donald Trump in this particular case is, let's take a little bit of a rewind, because you were talking about nailing things, and we know Hope Hicks nailed a lot of people in her time at the White House. You were also talking about things within your DNA, and there is something in her DNA, and I don't mean Corey Lewandowski. There is something in her DNA that we do have to discuss that came up in her previous testimony and why she's being subpoenaed now. People seem to forget that Hope Hicks admitted that she will lie on behalf of the president just because, hey, it helps move things along. Did we forget that?
Yes. Well, yeah, of course we did. We did. And you're absolutely right. We forgot it because look at our news cycle now. It moves at probably more real time and faster than we've ever seen in our society when it comes to the media. So it's very easy to forget unless we spot check it or file it and go back as a point of reference like you just did. But most people just keep it moving and forget. And that's the same mentality that she would have or Michael Cohen had to fall on the sword, so to speak, for Donald Trump. And even though she said that, it's documented, but yeah, they forgot. But if you take these words and fast forward and put it into where we are now, 2019, it still holds weight. That means that you just said the obvious. She would lie and do anything like, back in the day when I was a wrestling fan, there was a wrestler who used the term, I will lie, cheat, and steal. That's this administration. That's exactly what they do. They pretty much will tell you, I'll do what it takes. Protect the president. I'll do what it takes to lie, like Hope Hicks said. They'll do it. They pretty much tell you, look, this is who we are. You can't change us.
Mm. Now, can I go ahead and bring up something that I don't think any other report is going to bring up, but this is this show. I am this post. And of course, I'm going to point out something a little obvious that nobody else is going to see. Chris, this is one of the things that's bothering me about the Hope Kick, because I have a feeling she's going to get off on pretty white woman politics, where, oh, look at her. How could this virginal creature ever do anything so wrong? We should just let her off the hook. But if she was anybody else, they would grill her as if they were no tomorrow. Is there some sort of white pretty woman privilege at play here?
Yes. And I give a perfect example about that. If, even though you may not like it or not, you know, the ABC's The View is a good program nowadays for politicians to come on board. There was an article out of one of the New York papers that stated that The View is the place to go if you want for public office like the presidency. You see all these candidates come on The View and, you know, give their rhetoric, give their points of view, their bullet points of how to, you know, run the presidency. So we've seen that. My point is there's a co-host on there, Meghan McCain, who is Senator John McCain's daughter. Meghan McCain has to be the most coldest ice heifer I've ever seen in my life on television. And that's just putting it mildly. And she has this entire legend of white privilege. And my thing is just watching the show, whether it's a politician on there or there's a guest I like that I want to see, I want to check out. When she's on there, she believes that she can talk over people, be rude, and things of that nature. It's just completely out of pocket. But it's, again, not so the fact of just being a horrible broadcaster, as far as I'm concerned. It's their privilege things to come into play. So that's how she comes off to me. And other people I talk to in the business feel the same way. And not saying that other people don't have a different opinion about her, but again, it's the white privilege. So that comes off like, again, even though this is a whole table mentality of other women voicing their points of quote-unquote view, you got to listen to me. I'm the one. Y'all just, you know, pretty much, you know, just here. I'm the star type mentality and type of, you know, and that doesn't bode well for a multi-host program. And so fast forward to Hope Hicks, yes, in the eyes of the media, with this nice little version of that was funny. But going back to the whole thing of this shape or image of a white woman being, you know, coming after her and attacking her, we have to protect this fine white woman and type of thing. That happens, unfortunately. I'm glad you talked about that because it happens to be true. No matter what people say, there's an image factor that people buy into. As long as they're selling that image, oh, poor, you know, defensive white woman me, they're going to milk it for what it's worth.
You know, and when you talk about milking it, there is a high potential, especially with Hope Hicks' current position working with the Fox Network, that she will milk this for every bit of publicity that can be squeezed from it. But at the end of the day, I don't want anybody to forget that I'm predicting it right now. She will use the I'm too pretty and too white to do bad things defense. And I'm afraid it might work.
No, my guess is it will work. It's worked before with others, so why not work now? I mean, I'm not in a position where it did not work, because people buy into it. They buy into what they see. It's like, go back in the days of P.T. Barnum. Step right up. Here's Lily Fatima. She shakes her belly like a bowl full of jelly, type of thing. When you buy into it and you're sold on the idea, that's what you lock into your mind with. So again, go back to what you said about her being on Fox, milking it for what it is. I believe that, especially if we have a platform like she does for Fox News Channel, then there you go.
Mm-hmm. Because at the end of the day, this is going to be another woman that uses her appearance as a white woman to kind of skate by scrutiny that she would have gotten if she was, say, maybe 1/64th of 1,000th Native American like Elizabeth Warren.
True. Very much so.
You know, speaking of Elizabeth Warren, let's talk about her this week because she has had kind of an interesting renaissance. Now, last week when we were looking at Warren, she was kind of comfortably in third place. She was comfortably in fifth place when we first started looking at her. And it was one of those things where, of course, the white older men dominate the top three positions. But then all of a sudden, Elizabeth Warren made the jump statistically up to 4, then 3, and everybody was like, whoa, whoa. Then Buttigieg came up, and now he and Warren were fighting it out for 3. And just at the beginning of this week, Elizabeth Warren is in a statistical dead heat for number 2 right now of the DNC candidate with Bernie Sanders. Whoa, what is the whole thing that's got Elizabeth Warren on fire this week?
Well, like anything else, you know, it's a crapshoot. I mean, you have all these candidates, well, over 15 now pretty much are, you know, running for the presidency from the Democratic position. It's just like a mirror of what happened in 2016 on the Republican side. We had all those candidates that were, you know, running for the presidency back in 2016. So it's a mirror image of our side of the party right now. So look at the Democratic position. Elizabeth Warren, to me, has really thought this out. Not saying other candidates have not, but once again, I've seen her on The View, I've seen her on the programs, where she has a consistent message, a point-by-point step of how to improve, whether it comes to jobs coming back here to America, or whether it's dealing with the college tuition situation and paying, you know, the college tuitions back, institutions back. She has a concise plan for those and other issues she had talked about, and she doesn't waver from it. And again, when you talk about, just for example, college tuition, you know, people taking out student loans and things like that, when you're able to possibly get free education or go to a 2-year college and get that for free, and then we go to a 4-year college, maybe have more of a slash discount, or maybe do have, there's a set plan that she has, for example. So it's not just rhetoric, and it's not just, you know, go for vote for me, now I'll put some more, you know, food on your plate or tax breaks. It's a very concise, not, again, not taking anything with other candidates, but when you look at Elizabeth Warren, because of the fact that she's gone through the gamut with the president about the whole Pocahontas crap that he was saying to her and everything else, and she's been head above the shoulders of fighting that back and going forward, I think a person, Shaggy, at times, shows who they are in the way they comport themselves. And Elizabeth Warren is extremely consistent.
Yeah, because that's the thing that a lot of people are starting to be drawn to is Warren has a plan. That seems to be the mentality of every time she's been asked a question, she has a plan for it. She even had a plan for when the poor host of Nailed It, Nicole, couldn't get a date. And I'm going, why, Nicole? You have quiz. But she even had a plan for that lady. Elizabeth Warren seems to really kind of be on the come upping because as far as the DNC candidate, she doesn't do the pie in the sky defense like Bernie Sanders did this week of democratic socialism where, I mean, yeah, I know that he was trying to harken back to the New Deal and the Square Deal and the Great Deal and, I mean, the Great Society and stuff like that. But Bernie Sanders isn't finding any resonance with that message so much as Elizabeth Warren is with, I have a plan. Now, this is the thing, because eventually we're going to have to see her go head-to-head with Joe Biden. And I know I need to talk about her and Sanders, but I kind of want to talk about Biden for one particular reason. She's already squared off with him numerous times as an analyst, as a person that has been a testifier on the House floor, and just as a compatriot within the government. Elizabeth Warren and Joe Biden do have kind of a tit-for-tat history. Is there a good chance that she could knock Biden off the crown?
That's going to be a tough one. I think, like anything else, it's still early to tell. He has to sit back and do the wait-and-see mentality. But I go along with what you said about her being on the comeuppance, obviously, with these various polls. Like the recent poll we saw from Quinnipiac, you got Biden at 26%, and you have Warren at 16, and Sanders at 12. That's a good jump, especially when I would say maybe 4 months ago, she probably would have been at the lower part of the five, of the top five, not coming up to number 2. So again, we look at the progression movement that she has. I would say you're probably up against something that could probably shock the world, as Muhammad Ali once said back in the day, I shook up the world. Mm-hmm. We could see a possible tie between Biden and Warren at this point.
you know, the thing that really gets me too is like Bernie Sanders knew he was in trouble. I mean, he knew he was in big trouble this week, and that's why he kind of jumped on this whole speech of making democratic socialism is fulfilling the promise of our of previous generation to America to take care of Americans. He was really trying to drill in almost like a timeline of Americans being done with this ish that we're currently going through. It's going way back into the greatest generation. And a lot of people said that he did that because of Warren Sir, but do you think he'll actually be able to use a platform like Let's Fulfill the Great Promise to Elizabeth Warren's I Have a Plan?
Well, again, like anything else, you have two different styles of philosophies that are going on here. But the main thing was whose philosophy will show in the polls or show in the ratings of these candidates once we get towards the debates. I know the debates are happening coming up next month in Miami, the Democratic debate. So what's going to happen between now and then? What we're looking at, again, is people obviously gravitating towards philosophies that they feel speak to them. And if you're looking at competition, like Sanders, Sanders obviously should really take Elizabeth Warren seriously. Now, we all understand what Sanders went through back in 2016, trying to run for the presidency in the DNC and the Democratic, you know, and of course, unfortunately, had lost to Hillary Clinton. And of course, she lost to the man in the office. So we fast forward to now. I think if I was him, I look over my shoulder at Warren because or in front of Warren, depending on the poll. You have to know your surroundings. You have to understand that, again, once you galvanize your message and you're out there for all the world to see, the one thing they want to see is, again, consistency in your message and a set plan. So we'll see. I like to fast forward to when we see the debates from the Democratic nominees in Miami coming up. That's going to be the first time we all get a chance to see all these candidates go for broke and get their positions out and their agendas. And then we have a better feel of what we can see outside of individual town hall meetings, for example.
You know, that's the thing, because when it comes to all of the early debates, everybody comes up with their different platforms. Of course, there's Buttigieg with, hey, I'm a veteran. I want to take care of America like I thought I was doing in the uniform when I actually went to war. You have Klobuchar. You've got Tulsi Gabbard and a whole, I think Medea is running at this point. I mean, you've got a lot of people in the DNC field, but the front runners seem to be running on three different philosophies. One, centrist Joe Biden. Two, which would be now Elizabeth Warren with I Have a Plan. We're not there yet, but I have a plan and we can get there together with it. And then Bernie Sanders, Let's Fulfill the Promise of America to Americans. Out of those three philosophies, when they do go to have that debate, I'm wondering, will Elizabeth Warren's past experience with Biden actually pay off? What do you think?
I think it will. I think when before Biden got into the whole race, a lot of people were saying, will Biden throw his hat in the race? And obviously he did, but he took a while. He took his time. I think people close to him, obviously, was close to him, look, Joe, we need you. You know, get back in the swing of things, get back in the fray and see what happens. And if you do come out, you'll be the number one front runner and things like that. So people get into your ear, you get an exploratory committee, and then see what happens. So here we are now with Joe Biden. He obviously had to go through the gamut of him being too touchy-feely, him, you know, putting his hands on women and things like that when it came to embracement. Like going back to The View, for example. I told you these candidates go on The View. When usually a candidate goes out, they'll shake hands, you know, with the ladies on The View. He didn't touch nobody, which was a safe move because they would have said something, whether, you know, he shook their hand or gave them a hug. So that alone had to... And people kept saying, though, he's a hugging person. He's a hugging guy. And I've seen these other videos from other people online where he's creepy and the way he holds children and things like that. So you can spin the narrative, obviously. But it's the fact that he has to reinvent himself and apologize for a lot of things that he's done in order for people to take him seriously. Because nowadays, we're living in fact-checking. And you have to be very careful of your past actions or current actions because somebody will call you on it. So with the whole Elizabeth Warren, Joe Biden situation, that would be a nice debate to see when it happens. Once again, not talking about mudslinging, but centrist and I have a plan, actually going head to head to see what happens.
You know, and this is the thing, because this year we've seen kind of an uptick in stories like our last story of the day, whereas people are trying to erode certain civil liberties along what they say religious freedom or protection of family type of ways. Of course, I'm referring to the multiple times that we've had to talk about abortion on this show, but this week we're not talking about abortion, Chris. We're talking about chicken. The Texas governor recently signed something called a Save Chick-fil-A bill. That's the name of the bill, Save Chick-fil-A bill. What the hell is that about?
Well, pretty much protecting the rights of, in this situation, Chick-fil-A's position when it comes to LGBTQ community, that they're able to have their religious freedoms and rights. And, you know, when I read about this story, you always hear about separation of church and state. Can I have separation of church and food? I mean, see, when you start having politics in every facet of our lives, it just gets too messy. For example, you know, here on in the Midwest, other states, we have White Castle. Mm-hmm. Not famous of her burger chain for years. We call them sliders, and most people know that, because they slide right through you. You know, but back in the day when you were drinking and you needed something to pad your stomach, go get some sliders and you're good. Or if you didn't have any alcohol, depending on what you did, you go eat. So, but the thing about it is that I never mixed my politics with my food. It wasn't about the politics. I was just trying to have a good meal. The people who own White Castle, for example, are conservative. That's been stated. I don't care. You know what I'm saying? It's good food. So when we talk about the Senate bill that was passed, Senate Bill 1978, named after Chick-fil-A bill, that was Texas Governor Greg Abbott who went into it, about discrimination against the states against LGBTQ community, we shouldn't even have this conversation, I hate to say, because what's wrong with the fact of if a company has a certain value and that belongs to them, that's fine. But you mix it into the fact that would you second guess them? Would you judge them because of their political standings? Depends on you. I never Chick-fil-A before in my life. Never. I heard of it, obviously. Never had it. But if it's good food, I'm going to support it. But some people are like, oh, no, can't do it because they're Republican or they're Democrat or they're a nudist. We can't have it. Whatever it is, we're going to slide aside and find a way to separate. I get tired of that.
Yeah, and that's just it. In modern politics, we shouldn't cross too much, as they say in the Ghostbusters, we shouldn't cross our streams because, hey, I'm an admitted atheist, but I will go animal style at an In-N-Out in a heartbeat. And I know mm-hmm. what's on their food wrappers. I don't care. But whenever those restaurants can discriminate against us, I think, and I mean, we've got like 45 seconds here, Chris. I think mm-hmm. that we should fundamentally have a problem with being able to discriminate against people wanting to buy our products.
Exactly. No, let me take care of me. I'm a consumer. I'll go take care of that. I don't need somebody to say, hey, you can't do that because they're Republican or Democrat, conservative. I'm going to eat this burger. You know, I saw them make them pass the salami and bacon.
Exactly. Dude, thanks for being on this week's show. That's going to do it for all of our stories. If you would like to see more of it, go to shaggychinkets.com. Till next time. Love you, mean it.